All right. Let's move to the problem of evil. What do we mean by the problem of evil? We mean that the way to get the telephone to ring is to climb into the bathtub, basically. We mean that things are not quite right in the universe. You get into the bathtub and invariably the telephone rings. After you have answered it and gotten back into the bathtub, the doorbell rings and there's a Jehovah's Witness there. The problem of evil. In general terms, the universe isn't really what we would like it to be. There are all kinds of problems. And these problems include moral evils, people being nasty and vicious to each other. They include natural evils, earthquakes, tornadoes, and assorted miseries, so that the world is, in many respects, not a very happy place to live in. Now, the non-Christian, in observing this, and the more sensitive the non-Christian is, the more he's aware of this, the non-Christian, in observing this, frequently says to the Christian, look, don't bother with any evidence for the existence of your God. Don't bother me with the Bible, because your notion of God is incompatible and inconsistent with the way the world is. There couldn't be such a God. Logically, there couldn't be such a God, so we don't even need to check out evidence, because you claim that God is perfectly good and all-powerful. And if he's all-powerful and perfectly good, he certainly would have gotten rid of the evil that's in the world. Indeed, he wouldn't have allowed it in the first place. But the very fact that the evil is here shows definitively and unequivocally that that kind of a God doesn't exist. Now notice that this is a logical argument, or an illogical argument, if you will. That is to say, it's an argument based upon the notion that the Christian view of God is incompatible, inconsistent with the nature of the world. All that's necessary to do in answering this argument is to show that, as a matter of fact, the Christian view of God is compatible with the way the world is. It's a simple question of compatibility. It's a simple question of whether the world as we have it can exist alongside of the God that the Bible talks about. At this stage of the game, you do not need to prove that there is a God who is all-powerful and who is all-loving or all-good. Okay? All you have to do is to show that if there were such a God, that wouldn't be inconsistent with the evil that there is in the world. Now, the reason that I'm emphasizing this is that I am now going to try to show you on four levels, on the basis of four different considerations, that the biblical view of God is consistent with the way in which the world is, and indeed is the best kind of picture that you could imagine relative to the way the world is. But I'm not going to prove that the Bible is correct in the statements that it makes. That we're going to deal with on Thursday night, the reliability of the entire Bible. But at this stage of the game, we don't have to show that this biblical picture is true. All we have to do is to show that this biblical picture is compatible with the evil in the world. Because our object in this is to say to the non-Christian, listen, you're wrong. The evil in the world doesn't so block you off from the God of the Bible that you can get away with not considering the claims of Christ. As a matter of fact, the view that the Bible presents of God is entirely compatible with the evil that exists in the world. Therefore, this cannot be a roadblock for you. This is not a sufficient objection to keep you from going to the cross of Christ and considering the claims of Christ. All right? So it's a consistency question that we're dealing with here. All right. On four levels, we want to deal with the problem of evil. And we're going to begin on the simplest level and keep on moving. And the way we do this is that as we provide one answer, the non-Christian comes back with a deeper question, and then we've got to answer that, and so forth, and that will go on four times. All right, here we go. We first of all answer that the biblical picture of God is not inconsistent with the evil in the world, because God didn't cause the evil in the first place. God is not the cause of evil. The cause of evil happens to be the creature and not God. According to the biblical picture, evil is not the product of God, it is the product of the creature. The Bible says, first of all, that an angel fell, that Lucifer fell, and as a result of Lucifer's decision against God, evil entered the universe, and that evil had physical consequences. That is, it threw a monkey wrench into the universe so that not only did you have moral evil, but you had evil beyond that. Then also, as far as our world is concerned, the evil that came about for the human race came about as a result of the first creature making a similar decision. Adam decides against God, and in his decision against God, he destroys himself, and the ground brings forth nettles. He has to work with the sweat of his brow. His wife brings forth children in pain and agony. Paul says in Romans that the whole creation therefore groans and travails. So that the origin of evil is with the creature and not with the creator. You know, I'm sure, that the word Adam, the word Adam in Hebrew, means mankind. It is a general term for man. That is to say, in the words of the old McGuffey reader and the Puritan readers, in Adam's fall, we fell all. Adam was not simply a separate individual who made a bad choice. The biblical picture is that Adam was genuinely a representative man. In other words, had you been there, you would have done exactly the same thing. This makes it impossible for anybody to blame Adam, because Adam is a perfect statistical sampling, let us say, of all men, so that he adequately represents everybody. And nobody can say, it ain't my fault, he did it to me. The fact is that the guy complaining was actually in that situation himself. Now, of course, there is one difference between people after Adam and Adam. Namely, that in Adam's case, he had a completely free choice. Whereas, people after Adam are born into the world that Adam conditioned. In other words, the children of Adam are environmentally and hereditarily conditioned by Adam. The children of Adam are those who have received the biological gift from him, and they are born into a sinful environment which he created. So everybody after Adam has a choice among sinful possibilities, rather than a completely open choice between good and evil. As Luther put it, people have the complete free will to choose their own poison, subsequent to Adam. But if a person complains that he is limited only to evil choices, the answer to this is, well, you got into that yourself, because, again, Adam was truly representative of you. When he made that original decision, you were making that decision, and thus the environment that you presently experience is also your own fault. I've often found it helpful to quote John Donne's famous lines, "You ask for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee." And Donne's point is that the entire human race is integrated. No act happens to one human being that doesn't happen to others. The entire human race, in other words, is interlocked. And when you hear the bell toll for someone, it's actually tolling for you. This kind of interlocking is what the Bible talks about. All right, now the non-Christian, of course, comes back and he says, ah, all right, God didn't cause it. The creature caused it. But why did God allow the creature to get into that mess? That takes us to the second level. Why did God allow it? The answer to this, and it's been expressed classically and with great perception and clarity by C.S. Lewis in his book, The Problem of Pain, is that being love, God created people with free will. Love and free will are correlative. They're like love and marriage in any Get Your Gun. You can't have one without the other. You can't have love without free will. For God to create as a loving God, and the Bible says that God is love, God is agape, God is love, His creatures necessarily have to have free will so as to be able to choose Him or not, to accept His love or not to accept it. Let's take an analogy. You are dating that glorious young thing that we mentioned earlier, and at the end of a particularly magnificent date, you are there at the door and you say, did you have a lovely evening? And she says, yes, yes I did. And you say, all right, there's just one more thing. Love me! I don't suggest this. Tactically, this is a very bad method. It will not work. It is guaranteed not to work. Why? Because love cannot be compelled. Love must be freely chosen. If God had created creatures who had no choice but had to do what He wanted them to do, love would have been impossible. I mean, imagine it. There is God on the ramparts of heaven as the divine puppeteer. He is there holding the strings. And down below we have the creature. And God leans over the parapets and He says, Adam, do you love me? And down below Adam says, yes, God, I love you. It obviously would not be love. That kind of puppeteering would not permit a genuine love relationship. Which means that love and the possibility of rejection always go together. Love and the possibility of rejection go together. If you are a parent, you know well what I'm talking about. You cannot force your children only to make the right choices. If you try to do this, you will make it impossible for them to mature and you will eliminate any possibility of love. You know, every once in a while you read in the paper that the sheriff has beaten his way into the old farmhouse, and there he finds in the attic Lemuel, who is 36 years of age, and his mother has kept him there in the attic. And needless to say, Mrs. Winterbottom is on television that evening, and the commentator says, Mrs. Winterbottom, will you tell the television audience why you kept Lemuel in the attic for 33 years? And she said, well, I didn't want anything bad to happen to him. I didn't want him to suffer like the other boys suffer. I didn't want him to make the wrong decisions. See? Well, of course, Lemuel is a raving idiot. You know, he's just destroyed as a result of this kind of experience. You can't handle children that way. You've got to give them the genuine possibility of choice, even though that means the possibility of making the wrong choices. And this is fraught with awful consequences. This is why some people are simply afraid to have children, because of the possibility that the child, instead of returning love, will return hate and will simply spit in the parents' face and go off. But that possibility has got to be there in order for a genuine love relationship to exist. All right, we move on to the third level. The non-Christian says, all right, A God of love is then compatible with the existence of evil on the basis of free will. I'll admit that. But why does God have to allow the effects of evil? Why wouldn't it be possible to permit the choice, to have genuine free choice, but not allow the awful consequences that have come from this? Why do we have to have the wars and the miseries and all of the other things that have come about as a result of this? Couldn't you have a genuine free choice without all that? Answer, simply, no, you couldn't. Because the effects or consequences of a choice are bound up with the choice. You can't have a genuine free choice in isolation from effects. Let me give you another example. We'll say that my son David is only 4 years of age. And I say to him, now David, you know that your daddy loves you, right? Yes, daddy. You know that I want the very best for you. Yes, daddy. Now, among other things, Dave, we don't want to have you taking vases of flowers and turning them upside down on the living room rug, because that makes a mess, and your mother has better things to do than to clean them up. For example, there is a vase right at this moment on the mantle with flowers in it, and I don't want you to overturn that vase on the rug. Moment of silence. Evil gleam comes into the eye of David. He goes over to the mantle, grabs the vase, and inverts it. But I am prepared for this. Behind my armchair, I have a bucket. And as he inverts the vase, I quickly move the bucket out and place it directly under the vase, and I catch all of the flowers and all of the water. And I continue to do this in every moral situation in which I present an alternative to my son. Now, you will quickly note, if you analyze this, that this does in fact remove the free will, because it eliminates any moral character to this event. And after this has happened a few times, my son will no longer regard this as a moral issue at all. It will turn into a game. He will wonder what ingenious technique I will think of next to prevent any consequences of his negative decisions. The whole thing will turn into a different type of situation from a moral situation. It will turn into a non-moral game. In order for there to be genuine free choice on moral issues, the consequences have to follow from the decisions. However, the non-Christian poses this qualification of the question, but how come so many effects? I mean, wouldn't it be possible to allow just enough effects to give the decision a moral character, but not let things get out of hand? I mean, does it have to get to the point of 6 million Jews in gas ovens? Does it have to get to the point of Lisbon earthquakes, unfortunately not destroying Voltaire, but destroying other people? I mean, does it have to reach that consequence? The answer to this is, and this takes us, of course, to the fourth level, the answer to this is threefold. According to the Bible, God does limit the effects of sin, because if he didn't, we would have totally destroyed ourselves by now. Here we have a kind of eschatological entropy. We would have run down completely by now as a result of our sinful self-centeredness. According to the Bible, and the Reformers have set this forth with great effectiveness, God provided structures in society to keep us from destroying ourselves. These are called, in English, the orders of creation. The orders of creation. In German, they are the Schöpfungsordnungen, a magnificent word, which I will spell for those of you who would like to frighten your neighbors with a term like this if you ask me afterwards. But orders of creation is perfectly okay. They are such things as the state, the political order, the family, the economic order, the educational situation, the things that we call in history courses the phases of life. Without these, if God hadn't implanted these in the world, we would have destroyed ourselves by now. Take the political order just as one example of this. Hobbes noted in his Leviathan that human life is nasty, brutish, and short, and that without the state, human beings would be eating each other. They would be crawling around in the bush after each other, munching on their neighbors. The state is necessary in order to keep people from a might makes right sort of approach that absolutely eliminates any kind of meaningful society. You know, when Lisbon earthquakes occur or San Francisco earthquakes in which Clark Gable gets it, you know, that sort of thing, the result is that that good citizens are out looting. In the Watts riots down in Los Angeles, it was most interesting that the cameras picked up good citizens in taking television sets out of semi-destroyed stores. The fact of the matter is that civilization sits very lightly on us, and the civilization that we have is, according to the Bible, a gift of God by which He restrains us from destroying ourselves, and so on for the other orders of creation. I won't go into details as to why marriage is important. If it weren't for a structure of marriage in society, we wouldn't be eating each other, we'd be doing certain other things to each other. All right, in other words, we need these patterns of existence in order to operate, and God provides them. But not only has He restrained things in that respect, according to the Bible, He loved us so much that He came down to earth and died to deal with the fundamental problem of sin. He died on the cross to take care of the fundamental problem of our own willfulness. And of course, since we had freely chosen evil, that was an undeserved gift. It was something He gave to us without any kind of requirement on His part. In Romans 5, it says, "For a good man one might dare to die, but while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us." About the best that human love ever does is to die for someone who is equal to oneself or worth more than oneself. You remember Dickens' Tale of Two Cities, where the leading character dies for his double? It's a far, far better thing I do than I have ever done. And the reason why it's something that he feels he ought to do is because the double is of more value, he feels, to society and mankind than he is. But according to Romans, God goes infinitely beyond that. While we were yet sinners and not worth anything, God dies for us. And then thirdly, according to the Bible, God is going to make this situation totally right at the end. He is going to rectify this mess ultimately and bring good out of it all. The day is going to come when there will be a new heaven and a new earth, and He will wipe away every tear from our eyes. Now, what's the upshot of this? The upshot of all of this is that it's God's love that gave us free will. We misused the free will, and in consequence, the mess occurred. The only restraints in the situation are those that God provided out of His love, and He went so far as to give Himself unto death in our behalf. Under these circumstances, not only are we in no position to declare the Christian view of God incompatible with evil, but we're in the last position in the world to criticize God. Think of New York City during the garbage strike, all right? Suppose a person goes out and upbraids the garbage disposal people for not doing a sufficiently adequate job, all right? they answer, "It's because you have treated us the way you have that this whole garbage strike took place in the at the beginning. We didn't arbitrarily stop collecting the garbage. This came about because of your stiff-necked attitude toward the whole business. Moreover, the fact that this city is not totally inundated in garbage is due to the fact that in spite of the miserable pay you've given us, we are still collecting a certain amount of the garbage, and we will categorically clean up all this garbage once the strike is over. And since we're the only ones cleaning up the garbage, Mac, stow it. I mean, forget it. Don't criticize us. We're the ones who collect garbage, and you're in no position to complain when you're the ones who produce it." You see? The person who declares that the Christian approach to the problem of evil is off doesn't recognize where the locus of the problem is. The locus of the problem doesn't rest with God, it rests with the creature, and God has done far more in relation to this problem than any of us have ever thought of doing. All right, now it's sometimes argued in the following fashion, and I want to just speak to this before we open this up to questions. It's sometimes argued that an approach like this would necessitate a perpetual series of falls. In other words, once things get cleaned up, wouldn't there still have to be free will in order for love to exist? And therefore, wouldn't there have to be a repetition of this? Wouldn't there have to be an eternal series of falls if one deals with a problem of evil in this fashion? That's generally not an objection which is raised by the non-Christian, but often Christians wonder about this. In other words, once there's a new heaven and a new earth, can you have the whole problem start over again? Well, Augustine dealt with this back in the 5th century, and you can read what he did on it readily enough, but the best answer to it goes something like this. Adam fell, and as a result of Adam's fall, there was a conditioning to evil that continues on through the history of the race. In other words, that act against God was so negative that it had a spillover effect that went on through the history of the race. Suppose there were an act of good so powerful and so representative that it could have a spillover effect for good that would continue on inevitably and perpetually. Of course, such an act, according to the Bible, did take place in Christ. The second Adam came. He satisfied God's conditions and died for all men. And therefore, those who are locked into Him through faith, those who become one with Him through faith, are preserved from a subsequent fall because that conditioning spreads on in time and eternity, even as the original fall had that kind of an effect. You see, you don't have to have free choice at every moment, but you have to have decisive free choice in order for love to operate. Let me refer to a very important philosophical work on this subject, and if you'd like to get into it, you want to have some philosophical background. For those of you who don't have a philosophical background, the thing to read is C.S. Lewis' Problem of Pain. All right. But for those of you who would like to work on the philosophical question of evil, I refer you to Plantinga, Alvin Plantinga, Plantinga, a Christian philosopher teaching at Calvin College, Plantinga's God and Other Minds. And this book is published by the Cornell University Press. Alvin Plantinga, God and Other Minds, Cornell University Press. I do not suggest that you mess around with John Hick's book on the problem of evil. Hick is a very strange sort of philosophical theologian. This book is singularly unhelpful in dealing with the whole business. I'll be referring to Hick in some other connections. Maybe I'll refer to him right now. John Hick, in trying to deal with the meaningfulness of the idea of God, has suggested what he calls eschatological verification, that you can really have a meaningful idea of God. And the reason for this is that once you die, if you believe, you will find out whether there's really a God. In other words, this is testable. And all you have to do is to die believing, and you will discover that there is a God. Now, Hick is a liberal Presbyterian who doesn't believe in hell, and therefore this is not a symmetrical verification, because if you're an unbeliever, you simply cease to exist, and then you don't find out, see? But if you are a believer, all you got to do is die, and then there is a definite evidence in behalf of God. Now, you know, almost any commentary would be superfluous. We could note that for most people, the problem is important enough that it really needs to be decided now. I mean, if you don't decide until later, you just might be too late. And if by any chance there is a hell, it becomes especially important to get this thing straightened out now and not wait for eschatological verification. Well, Hick has also done a book on the problem of evil, and I suggest that you not bother particularly with that. Planting as God in other minds is far more significant.